Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a great panel standing by to talk about big news breaking all over the place in Washington, here in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, among other places. Before we introduce the panel and get into the topics for conversation, a couple quick items. Number one, once again, we are on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB News Facebook page or go to our website at GPB News, which is gpbnews.org/PR. You can watch what we're doing in the studio right now if you want to watch the program as it unfolds and leave comments and questions. That's been one of the most interesting things in the week since we've started putting video of the show up, is to get comments from all of you, both good and sometimes bad. That was Andre Gillespie, Dr. Andre Gillespie, who is with us today and just waved at the camera. That was good. I liked that.
She's wearing pearls, too.
We don't know when the camera is on us, by the way, so I guess we have to sit here and smile the entire time.
We have three cameras in here to cover everybody, and we also recognize that the shots are a little tricky because the microphones get in the way a little bit, but we're working on that, and we're going to move forward. That was Beth Shapiro. She is a now retired, a former pollster, usually worked with Democratic candidates, was a Democratic political consultant, did a lot of work in the corporate community, so we're glad that you're with us today. And Dr. Andre Gillespie, of course, political science professor from Emory University. Also, Heath Garrett. He's a Republican consultant, a Republican strategist, and a longtime Atlanta political consultant. Worked with everybody from Johnny Isaacson to who are a few others?
Sam Olens, Chris Carr.
Yeah. Okay. And, of course, Jim Galloway. You heard his voice briefly. He is the lead political writer for the AJC, and you can also look at him on the Political Insider blog at PoliticallyGeorgia at myajc.com. What's it cost to subscribe?
Oh, $3 and change. Come on, cheap. You can afford it.
Cheap. And lots of good and important news. The other quick announcement before we get going is we're coming to Macon. For those of you who are down in Middle Georgia, we don't have all the details yet to give you, but we wanted to make sure you knew now that we'll be there on Thursday night, April 12th. Galloway has just told me he'll come down, which is good.
Yeah, it's just a two-hour drive from the house.
Yeah, it's easy. And we'll be announcing details on where you can go to get specific information, how you can get ticketed. Of course, it's a free ticket, but we like to keep track of who plans to come to make sure we have enough room. And we'll be announcing that in the days ahead. But April 12th, Thursday night, if you're living in the Macon area, we would love to see you come down and talk to us. Okay, enough announcements. Jim, on Friday afternoon, as we were sitting here getting set to do the Friday show, a story came in that we decided we should have a little more information about before we talked about it. Because it's a sensitive issue, obviously, and we don't have as many details as we'd like to have. But now we're learning enough that we have to talk about the story. David Schaefer, longtime state senator, candidate, the leading candidate for lieutenant governor.
Former president pro tem.
Of the state senate, has now been accused by a veteran lobbyist of sexual harassment. Tell us about it.
It was filed last week on Tuesday, actually. And I think the same day that he qualified as a candidate, as a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. We are not publishing the name of the woman, but apparently they've known each other for quite some time. They've been in Republican campaigns together since about the 1990s. She alleges that he made some rather suggestive demands in order to support a piece of legislation that she was pushing. The lobbyist's kind of client list is pretty standard. There's nothing there that stands out too much at this point that I see. She says that Mr. Schaefer said he'd help her with her legislation if she showed him her breasts. The legislation was help. He came back to her, and she says, no, thank you. It's a rather detailed complaint.
Yeah.
She has hired Bruce Harvey, a pretty well-known litigation attorney.
Very tough attorney.
For here. And of course, Schaefer has denied it all. He says it's politically connected. As I said, the news broke after qualifying ended on Friday, but on the same day that he qualified for that office on the previous Tuesday.
We should point out, she says, and by the way, why has the AJC decided to withhold her name? Do you know the
standard
reason?
Standard policy on sexual misconduct?
Okay,
we don't
just want to explain that to our listeners.
Right, right.
This isn't an exceptional case being done just so people aren't suspicious out of some desire to somehow shield David Schaefer from what's going on.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right.
So she says, by the way, that this went on for a long period of time. You know, Andre, it's interesting. The Me Too movement has really not hit the state capitol and legislators there as it has so many other people in so many industries. And I guess one of the reasons is that the legislature, particularly, they deal with these things in private. But now you bring it right out in the open. It strikes me, not only is it going to make some difference in Schaefer's campaign, it's going to put that issue on the map in a larger way for this election cycle.
Well, if this hadn't done it, it would have been some other case. And, you know, knowing that the Democratic gubernatorial candidate is going to be a woman, whoever she is, I think would have also brought a lot of these issues to the forefront anyway. So I don't think anybody should be surprised that this has finally hit the Georgia State Legislature. I think everybody in every industry should be prepared for allegations like these to come out, and that there has to be some type of reckoning with the issue. And at least as far as this is concerned for this race, because this is a co-partisan and because this has the potential to impact the primary results, this is not just the type of thing where I think you can just say this is sort of like partisan sort of volleying going back and forth. This is something that each party is going to have to deal with. And in all honesty, people in all parties need to be prepared for allegations like this to be coming out about politicians, you know, regardless of the level of government, regardless of the office being held.
And it's certainly not the way you want to launch a statewide campaign. I think the timing has the potential to do some serious damage to Schaefer's race. And I think, Heath, you can probably speak better to that than I can. But just as a strategist, I certainly wouldn't want my candidate to be hit with any type of charge like this when the campaign is just officially getting started.
No, that's exactly right. I think the rumors about this particular case and several others have been floating around the political consulting world on both the Democratic and the Republican side for the last 4 or 5 months, really since the movement did. I think you're right, Bill. It's kind of shocking that more state legislatures haven't started to feel the impact of it, but I think this is the kind of tipping point of that. And there's no question that this is not the way you want to start a primary for lieutenant gubernatorial, and it has shaken up that race in a way that we haven't seen in modern politics in Georgia in a long time.
I want to make sure I heard something you said. You said you're surprised not more state legislatures, as in across the country, or legislators here in Georgia, or both?
Both, actually. I mean, I think this is kind of, you know, there's an open secret in most state legislatures around the country that this kind of behavior has been going on for decades, if not since time immemorial. And I agree with everybody that, you know, time's up on this, and we can't be having it in boardrooms, corporate C-suites, or state legislatures, number one. And number two, the rumors have been out there about other legislators as well in the state of Georgia. And so anybody with these kind of fact patterns in their past history, you know, should be nervous. And, of course, we've, you know, talked to all of our clients to make sure that they've done an inventory and started to think through and do those kind of things. But I think more is coming.
Yeah. Basically, with this particular race, you've got three Republicans in there. Schaefer's has been considered the front runner. Then you've got Jeff Duncan, a former House member from Cumming, and Rick Jafaris of McDonough, also a Republican. I'd be hard put to say who once this really sinks in, who would be the new front runner if that changes. But if we can go back to what you said, when you vet a client, when you are getting ready to sign on with a client, how deep does that questioning go? When you're saying what have you got in the closet that you don't want out?
Right. So I think the true professionals in the business do as much research on themselves or their client as they do on the opposition in this case. And so I've been fortunate to work with folks who went through that vetting and did not have skeletons anywhere near like this in their background. But a lot of political consultants have a different, you know, ethical standard, and they'll work with basically anybody. And so the answer to that, Jim, is some political consultants do a complete vetting, know about this, and then it disqualifies, and they don't work with a client like that has had problems like this. Others compromise around it, and then a lot of times, you know, candidates do not provide this kind of information. You don't know until it's too late.
So let's not let any more time go by without saying that David Schaefer has vigorously, emphatically denied this. The quote is, "This false complaint is about politics, not the truth, and that is why it is no coincidence that it was filed the day after I qualified to run for lieutenant governor." So we want to make sure we say that Schaefer.
And if you and Bill, I would also throw I've put up in the post this morning that the some people that we have here on the on the show, Mark Roundtree and
Republican pollster
and Julianne Thompson.
Well, and I wanted to mention the Julianne Thompson quote and get Beth and Andra to weigh in on it. So Julianne Thompson, of course, is a frequent panelist on the show. And here's the quote that she gave to you, Jim. "There is a national hysteria, a witch hunt. Anyone can accuse anyone of anything, and people are publicly shamed for not automatically believing the accuser. I don't believe this for 1 minute. If you've spent any time in Georgia politics, you know how ridiculous this is." Interesting, odd to hear this coming from a woman in the Republican Party to you, Andra?
Well, what I'll say this, and Julianne, because of our interactions on the show, I would count her as a friend.
Sure.
And, you know, I've met David Schaefer. When it's one accuser, there is still some doubt. The question becomes whether or not this opens the floodgates, and all of a sudden you start to have multiple accusers who are telling detailed stories that don't look like they completely kind of came out of nowhere. So I think because we're still at the beginning of this investigation, the jury is still out on it. But the fact that Julianne is a woman, I think, is actually an interesting case. Like, if this had come out in general election season and it looked like the accuser was a Democrat and you could sort of make a more credible case that this was partisan, you know, that this was there was a partisan motivation behind this, I think it would be somewhat easy to dismiss this case. The thing that I will be looking for in the general and in the primary election is to see what the behavior of Republican women looks like. Right. So we've seen nationally how it seemed like President Trump was inured from, like, you know, women react, Republican women, I should say, reacting negatively to him. Roy Moore in Alabama, the same thing. When it's a primary and you have the option of having another Republican sort of fill this particular slot, do we see an impact at all on overall sort of how people respond to Schaefer in terms of how they vote for him? And then also in particular, how women vote? I think this is an interesting place.
Beth?
And I think what we're seeing from Senator Schaefer is classic damage control. And in cases like this, you try to get credible women out there saying something about you. And in this case, he's got two credible women, Kay Godwin and Julianne, who are well-respected Republican leaders. So I think what he's doing is what I would be advising a candidate to do in a similar circumstance. I think one of the implications of this is for the Republican primary, I would look to his two opponents to be featuring women in a lot of their ads and a lot of their communications with voters. The other one last item in terms of thinking about November, that there is a woman running for lieutenant governor as a Democrat. I think she's unopposed. So there are two people. Okay.
Two women.
There are two women. So regardless of who wins the Democratic primary, the Republican lieutenant gubernatorial candidate will be facing a woman. So there'll be two women at the top of the ticket for the Democrats, which I think will make just adds another little interesting twist to this mix.
Jim, do you think this is going to open the floodgates? We all have it. Heath alluded to the fact that there have been rumors for quite a while about people down at the mm-hmm. state capitol, some of whom may be running for in this election cycle. Do you believe that we're about to be hit with a lot more of this sort of thing in this election cycle?
Well, elections are in many ways a test of you're seeking promotion. You're moving from one spot where maybe you've been for many years, and you're moving to another spot. You've got a lot of people who haven't undergone a whole lot of scrutiny for a good while because you're having a large turnover in leadership in the state capitol. So you have people being tested in many, many ways, and their relationships with other people are among those tests.
Yeah. Heath, it's interesting that Andra pointed out how President Trump has managed to stay above it all despite many of the accusations against him. But it is also interesting that just this week, I think yesterday or maybe even this morning, we've seen a new poll of evangelicals, and evangelical women are now moving away from Trump in pretty significant numbers. His approval ratings among evangelical women is down like 13%. That's bigger than the total percent that he's down in the overall evangelical community, clearly. So that tells us maybe he is no longer invulnerable on these issues.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I've heard anecdotally the same type of conversations going along in the faith-based community, particularly in the Republican side of politics, that the Stormy Daniels stories and the kind of the whole concept of this, something that's caused, giving everybody a pause from a character standpoint. Beth can speak to this having been a pollster, but shares our values is still one of the most powerful indicators of whether or not a group of people will support a Democrat or a Republican in any poll. And so there's no question in this national movement, the President of the United States, no elected official is immune from this. And I do say that one of the reasons why you may not see a floodgate, right, is because people that are involved in politics, particularly women who are lobbyists or who are employed, again, have this kind of, there's a disincentive to come forward because they're having to choose between their livelihood and what they're doing. So I think we in the leadership of the both parties have to figure out mechanisms and ways. And I think that's what's going to be, this will force that issue in the state legislature. How do you give women the opportunity to come forward without jeopardizing it, their livelihood and their life? And that's a constant struggle in all this.
You know, as we finish out this particular topic, as we talk about this, it suddenly hits me that if you've been an observer at the state capitol or a participant in the legislative sessions in one form or another over the years, you really realize how incestuous, and I obviously don't mean that term in the sexual connotation that it has, but the relationship between lobbyists and legislators is, Jim, incredibly, intensely intimate in the sense that they are dealing with each other day in and day out. And when he says, if you're a woman who's been harassed, you have to decide whether you can afford to come forward, it's because the intensity of those relationships really makes it difficult.
And you're leaving out one facet.
Okay.
The campaign worker.
Yeah. Right.
Because and sometimes you can shift from campaign worker to legislature to lobbyist. It's all a nice little Gordian knot.
Okay, let's do this. Let's take a quick break and get the first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, one of the things I love about this show is that when you all come in as panelists, sometimes you bring us news we didn't even know was happening, and that's the case of a story we're going to address. When we come back, Jim Galloway, just what does the word liberty mean? We'll talk about that in a minute. This is Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Heath Garrett is with us, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway. Jim, I said, kind of teasing this segment of the show, what does the word liberty mean? Why have I asked that question?
Well, maybe it doesn't mean what you think it means.
Well, why don't you explain what the situation we
all
have
right now? Well, we have about 5 years ago, taxpayers ponied up maybe $3 million to convert an old parking lot, across from the state capitol, and made it a very nice looking park to hold rallies, to kind of move the population that would gather and demonstrate in front of the capitol off of Washington Street and into some safer areas, quite frankly, that you don't have to block traffic for. And Of course, when you hold, if you build something like that, people are going to come to it. We had a case last month where an anti-gun violence rally organizers set up shop there. The Georgia Building Authority says they didn't do the proper permitting, so they turned off the electricity that runs the sound system. So there was no, they could rally there, but they just couldn't hear each other.
And then they sent an employee out to unplug megaphone or speaker
they shut down the electricity.
Rally had brought in.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The electricity was on and then it was shut off. Now we find out that we've got Saturday, March 24th, much larger rally, and anti-gun violence, same topic, scheduled for Liberty. Well, they wanted to have it at Liberty Park. Now they're finding that it has been denied.
Yeah, this is the rally that coincides with the big national rally in Washington, the March Against Guns, and the GBA.
Against Gun Violence.
Against Gun Violence. Thank you very much, Beth Shapiro.
You're welcome.
GBA says no.
Well, yeah. Now here's the reason. This is where it gets very interesting. They said off hours, say after 6 p.m. or on weekends, rallies there have to receive the approval of a constitutional officer, a state constitutional officer, a governor, a lieutenant governor,
right.
An insurance
company. So Keith Garrett, wait.
Yes.
We've two events in a row now, neither of which really are in keeping of the point of which is not in keeping with the majority,
right.
The Republican majority that's running things downtown. We've had two different reasons given by GBA for why those rallies shouldn't take place. And maybe those rationale are reasonable. But this is Liberty Plaza. You'd think after one problem with the previous march that Steve Stansel, the head of the building authority, would do everything in his power to show that it really is a Liberty Plaza.
Well, the irony is not lost. And I think that is absolutely the perception could become reality here and should not. Right. Obviously, there are time, place, and manner restrictions under the First Amendment. We've all respected those. But if something's called Liberty Plaza, it really becomes difficult to start to pick and choose who is and isn't allowed. You shouldn't do that based on political speech. It's the most protected form of speech we have. We as conservatives are arguing that our rights are being violated on college campuses all over America. So I think for us to maintain credibility on that and say we want the First Amendment protected, we need to broaden the use of Liberty Plaza in a way that allows for appropriate costs and safety and all the other things that go along with a rally. But this is one where I think people thinking through bureaucracy have missed the forest for the trees, so to speak.
And, but in this case, though, it's the governor's office that the group applied to. So it's the governor's office that particular constitutional office that said you can't have the permit, which I find really kind of surprising because this is a governor who's gone to great lengths to try to project a tolerant, moderate-ish image for the state of Georgia, particularly in the context of trying to lure Amazon and companies like that. And yet the governor's office is saying that a group of citizens who are petitioning to assemble peacefully mm-hmm. can't have that permit. That's surprising. Frankly, I find it outrageous. And I'm glad that we're talking about this today.
I mean, I completely agree with Beth. And, you know, let's just assume in this case that this was some low-level bureaucrat in the governor's office who makes this call. And this could be a lack of discretion, but this seems very politicized in that particular sense. So in many ways, let's just assume this person goes rogue. Now that this has been publicized and there's sunlight on it, now it's time for Governor Deal to step up and say, look, this is stupid. People have a right to be able to speak. It is unreasonable based on the statute to assume that they should even be going through all these hoops on a Saturday. Of course, that's the most convenient day of the week for people to be able to protest. And we're going to let it happen even if we don't like what they have to say.
And by the way, they weren't limited going to the governor. They could have made the appeal to the lieutenant governor, to the insurance commissioner, to the labor commissioner, to the agriculture commissioner,
right.
Or to the secretary of state. But poor old House Speaker David Ralston doesn't qualify as a constitutional officer.
Oh, of course not.
So he could not approve that.
Right, because he's only elected in one district and then elected speaker by the members of his body. All right, let's move on. Let's go from downtown Atlanta to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. President Trump was in Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, for a rally Saturday night for Rick Saccone, the Republican candidate for a special congressional election that takes place tomorrow. We're going to talk about that election and the implications that it may portend in a moment. But before we do, Congresswoman Karen Handel went to that rally Saturday night. She was there, and President Trump made sure that he gave her a shout out. But is in keeping with the president, he just wants to relitigate the past every chance he gets, so he couldn't stop himself from talking about the Democratic candidate against her, John Ossoff.
I brought him down in a period of 4 days. I got no credit for this from these guys. Brought him down from 58 to 48. So now he's in a runoff with Karen. So think of it. He's at 48. She's at 15. By the time Karen and I finish with this guy, $32 million he spent. And she spent slightly less than that, okay? She spent like about $29 million less, right? She spent $29 million less. But by the time we finished, the winner, easily by 5 points, was Karen Handel. So, right. Right. And they love the job she's doing, and I think you're going to have a good victory now. But the people have gotten to know you, and they love you in your area, and hope I don't have to go and make speeches all over the place like last time.
So, Heath, if PolitiFact were going to take on just this portion, this 42nd portion of the Trump speech, they would need 3 pages in tomorrow's AJC. Karen Handel did as much as she possibly could to keep as far away from President Trump, except for a brief...
during the runoff, but during the initial stage.
In the initial race, of course. And he got the numbers on spending a bit as she spent. Go ahead.
She is doing a great job as the congresswoman for the 6th Congressional District. I want to give her credit for that. I imagine what's happened here is that he may have been given those numbers by some people around him who wanted him to feel as if he was impactful. Look, he was definitely impactful in the race, right, on both sides. He motivated the Democrats and he motivated the Republicans. He is that president, so if he wants to claim that he was the deciding factor.
Ossoff was never at 58%.
No. Exactly.
No. Karen Handel was never at 58%,
and she was only in the runoff, but there's no question that Karen Handel deserves a lot of credit for the race that she ran and that a lot of people on the race.
Wait. You think that Karen Handel deserves, you're a Republican, you think Karen Handel deserves credit rather than President Trump, Heath?
all I can tell people is he is the greatest motivational factor on both sides of the political divide right now.
Well, and that raises
and
the
so
question.
He did help.
And that's the question I want to ask you all. So if that's true, is getting the embrace of President Trump at this point as much a motivation for Democrats to mobilize up there against Karen Handel in the election coming up in 18? Or is this going to almost assure that she turns out a Republican majority?
No, I mean, I don't think anything is guaranteed. And so this is all a matter of turnout and how organized both sides are in actually getting their people to turn out to vote. So, President Trump, does that actually have the potential to mobilize people? Yeah, I think that might be why you attribute record turnout. But in terms of what the overall fundamentals of the vote looks like I caused John Ossoff to drop 10 points. He dropped 10 points in your misstating of things, for sure. But he had 48%. After the first ballot, and he was about in the same place for the second ballot. So in that respect, proportionally speaking, I'm not sure how much he, lost John Ossoff anything, especially as the electorate grows in that respect. As far as, advice that I would give to Democrats about this, you can't just run on a Donald Trump as president type of platform and not have anything else to do. And so while I watched that speech over the weekend and was catching the lies and actually heard more here than I actually picked up the first time that I heard it, one of the things that I will give President Trump credit for is he does a really good job of explaining things simply. Doesn't matter that he's misleading, because it wasn't just this Handel thing. It's the whole VATs or tariffs. There was all kinds of stuff that he was saying in there that, was completely made up. but he says stuff in a simple and non-condescending way, and that's part of his appeal because, you know, these voters are voters who feel that eggheads in D.C. talk down to them and think that everything is too complicated to explain it to them. And he's like, no, I'll explain it to you in layman's terms and to the point that you get it. It just doesn't matter to them where they may not know or realize how much he is making stuff up as he's saying it. And it's just not true.
I think that says just about it. It says about all. Anybody else want to weigh in?
This just reminds me, right? His whole thing is don't take me literally, but take me seriously. And his opponents take him literally, but not seriously. And his supporters take him seriously, but not literally. And it's who he is. He's always been this way as a businessman.
But that's very unfortunate for the country that he's saying, I'm going to lie, so don't take me literally. No. And we can't even come up with a set of facts to agree on.
The one thing I don't, people are tagging him for lying, ignore political hyperbole of the Democratic Party for the last 50 years, right? And so, again, we don't hold President Obama to the same standard, even though because his hyperbole or lack of literalness was more subtle or sophisticated. But he is who he is. So I'm not saying that is perfect, and you call balls and strikes on it. But to act like that he's the first politician or elected official to misstate numbers or facts, I don't disagree that politicians misstate numbers and facts,
but I think that is a completely false equivalence in terms of the kind of human being that Donald Trump is and the kind of human being, ethical, moral human being that Barack Obama is, to state them as equivalents because they could not be more different.
I think they're different. They're going to be equivalent.
But if we can move on just a little bit, I mean, we've got a very interesting test coming up tomorrow. Yeah. In Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh area.
Yeah, we've got Rick Saccone, the Republican legislator, running for this open seat. And just before we came on the air, about 45 minutes before we came in, this is a district Trump won by 20 points in western Pennsylvania in 2016. Monmouth University, which is considered a very respected polling, isn't it, Andrea? You pay attention to polls. Monmouth is usually kind of way up there in terms of credibility. They have Connor Lamb, the Democrat, leading that race by as much as 7 points, as few as 2 points, depending on the size of the turnout. Nevertheless, they show the Democrat leading.
And it's very significant. I'll tell you something about myself that you don't know, Bill. I have steel mill connections.
Okay. So you're all for the tariffs.
My wife's family is from a steel family up in Weirton, which is just below Pittsburgh. Her granddad was a vice president of the company there. And we watched it tank. And they tried to revive it, and then it tanked again, revived it, and tanked again. I will tell you two things to point to that I'll be looking at tomorrow. Is number one, the unions have really kind of they've made a little bit of a comeback in that district, and they're supporting Lamb pretty much to a man. So that's fairly significant in terms of the traditional dynamics of the Democratic Party. I would also point you to the school teacher strike in West Virginia that just got settled last week, which is just, like I said, a couple miles south of this congressional district. And the school teachers hung in there, and they got a major victory in a state without a teacher's union, but with a long union tradition.
All right, here's what's interesting, among other things. Jim's already pointed out, but Beth, here's what's fascinating about the race. First of all, it is generally acknowledged, and Trump allegedly made a comment before or during sometime when he wasn't on mic and on camera trash-talking Rick Saccone. Saccone has apparently not been a particularly good candidate. He's not any good at fundraising. His campaign organization, reports have it, has been moribund. It's the National Republican Party that's had to really come in and push to get him energized for this election. But here's what really, I think, becomes even more interesting in terms of how Democrats will deal with this. Connor Lamb is running. He says, I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker if Democrats win the majority. He is supporting Trump's tariffs. And, of course, what Galloway just said tells us why he would be doing that. And he's opposed to new gun safety regulation. He is running about as moderate a Democratic or conservative a Democratic campaign as you can in that district.
Which is fine. The last time I checked, the Democratic Party is a relatively large tent. We might have noisier factions at one point in time than the other. But I think it's important that Democratic candidates match their districts. And in this case, he's an interesting example of something that's happening nationally. There is a Democratic congressman from Boston, Massachusetts, Seth Moulton, who's a first-term member of Congress. He's a former Marine, decorated Marine, served in Iraq, a tour or two in Iraq. And he has started a PAC called Serve America. And I just happened to have been at an event with him this past Friday. So I've heard a lot about it. I won't tell you a lot about it. But basically, this PAC is recruiting Democratic candidates who have served the country. Most of them are former veterans of the armed forces. There's an ex-CIA person, and I forget, there's somebody else who's not strictly military. But they have identified 19 or 20 candidates across the country, and Lamb is one of them that they are supporting. And they are supporting people who match their districts. And so I think we're going to see other Democratic candidates running in some of these potential swing districts who do not hew to what people think is a Democratic Party line. And that's fine. I think for those of us who would like to see more Democrats get elected and ultimately take back the House, I frankly don't care, almost don't care what they believe. I just think it's important.
Wait. If a Democrat runs against new gun safety laws, Are you suggesting that may be a disingenuous position and that you're hopeful that when that woman or man gets to Congress, they will vote differently?
No. The reality is that if whichever party controls Congress controls the committees, and while one individual's voting inclinations or voting record is not enough to swing the vote in Congress, the fact that the majority party can control what legislation comes out of committees and ultimately get voted on, that's what's important. No, I'm not saying people go, yes, some people do go and switch their positions, but I'm not advocating that. And I'm not saying that most members of Congress do that either.
And so I think it's a balance. So you have the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that's advocating oftentimes for complete and total consistency. And sometimes I think the question this year is whether or not the perfect is the enemy of the good in this situation. And then there is this reality that you have to have some congruence with the district. So Nancy Pelosi couldn't run in the Pennsylvania 18th, regardless of what political conditions are out there. I mean, I think in terms of kind of being disingenuous, the idea that President Trump would say that basically Connor Lamb is lying to you, he's going to vote with Nancy Pelosi all the time, he's going to be bad on steel, though he said, no, he's going to be bad on guns, he's going to be soft on crime, though he's a former prosecutor. Like, yeah. There are all of these things that the president anyway was trying to spin against Connor Lamb that we need to wait to see tomorrow whether or not Lamb has inoculated himself enough so that people, the vast majority of voters in the district, not just the ones who showed up at that rally, will sort of consider sort of the totality of him and whether or not they feel that they know him personally.
All right. So Jim and Heath, you both get a crack at this. If Connor Lamb beats Rick Saccone in this race tomorrow, it's an earthquake, isn't it?
I would say I will jump in there and before Heath and just say Katie barred the door.
Yeah, I mean,
and then of course, I always like to try to provide a little bit of context to this. There have been five special elections in the House. Republicans have won all five of those.
How about the Senate?
The one Senate, in Alabama because of the
they lost the governor's race in Virginia in a state that
pretty purple, right? I mean, the one the shocker was Alabama because of Roy Moore, but that was because the primary politics. But
go ahead, make your point.
But I do think the media will absolutely make it out to be an earthquake. The question is in context: is it really? And B, like the sixth congressional district. A special election is one thing when the entire democratic infrastructure of the world can concentrate on one district for one moment in time with a maybe weak Republican. But when we default back to November, right, and you get normal presidential level turnout and money gets dispersed again, the question is, will this, do this? I don't think it's a one race for the Democrats.
So Keith, here's an argument.
I hope they're not setting themselves up for disappointment again.
But here's an interesting argument that's contrary to what you just said. It is also unlikely that in the national elections coming up that Republicans will be able to dump the amount of money that they have to try to give Saccone a victory in that district, so that even if Conor Lamb loses by a couple of points, I think there's going to be a lot of analysis that suggests things are up for grabs.
Yeah. And Heath, I will say I will agree with you in one point here. I think what happens tomorrow in Pennsylvania isn't nearly as important as what happened in Georgia last week, when we saw this explosion of female candidates.
That's right.
And if you're looking for that Katie barred the door sign, that was it.
I think that's exactly right. I think the question is, what does happen tomorrow in Pennsylvania, right? What really happens with turnout? And then we'll kind of turn towards, most elections are won the day that qualifying ends and your two candidates are set in the modern political context.
And just keep in mind that all of Pennsylvania's congressional seats are being in the process of being litigated for redrawing. So whatever the Pennsylvania 18th looks like, it's probably not this district.
Thank you for pointing that out. We're going to have a winner tomorrow in a district that by the November elections will be entirely different than the one that winner gets elected out of tomorrow. That's going to be really interesting to watch unfold. By the way, just a historical note as we go to our break. When Gary Hart first, when he ran for president in 1988, he announced his candidacy sometime in 87, I don't remember when, and started in Denver. You know what the last stop on his announcement tour was? Because I went on that tour. He went to Pittsburgh, and he went to the mills. Where the area is called Homestead. I can't remember what it's called. But anyhow, he went to the steel mills where he talked about, we have to revive American steel. It's all collapsing around us. And here we are some 40 years later. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump, when people say Donald Trump is reliving the 80s, he really is. So, all right, let's get a second break of the show out of the way. When we come back, we still have a lot of stuff to talk about. We'll do that on Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Rania Abu Zaid. Banned from entering Syria by the Syrian government, she continues to go back to report on the war. In her new book, No Turning Back, she writes about rebel fighters and families caught in the middle. As a child, she also saw war up close. She was raised in Australia, but her Lebanese family would visit war-torn Beirut. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Producer Tom Faust points out it was Homestead, excuse me, was the name of the area that we went to with Gary Hart. I apologize. I'm suddenly having trouble talking. Jim Galloway is here, Beth Shapiro, Andre Gillespie, and Heath Garrett. Heath, we're going to, let's start with Galloway, and then we'll point out you have a disclaimer to make. We always talk, Jim, about the fact that surprises happen in qualifying, and sometimes we don't even get the surprise until a little bit later once qualifying is closed and we've all looked things over. Hank Johnson has now served as the Democratic congressman out in DeKalb County for 11 years, I think, since he defeated
Cynthia McKinney.
And there's a Republican now in that race. His name is Joe Proffitt. Who is he?
He's an African-American, I think, former Falcon football player.
Running back.
Has a few restaurants that he has ownership. And I've got to say that the literature says he's not going to win.
What do you mean the literature says?
Well, I mean you have a lot of actual some very very good and our good doctor can explain this, but you've got a lot of studies out there about whether black voters vote by race the way that white voters vote by race and actually they make some fairly big distinctions.
So in this particular race, where you've got two black candidates running against each other, party is obviously what's going to be the thing that matters most. So the thing that you would look at, the question that I have asked and stuff that, you know, I've presented at conferences but haven't published yet, is whether or not black Republican candidates are actually disadvantaged by the combination of race and party. And
I'd love to get in front of research. In front of publication. This is great.
Yeah. So, I mean, in general, in this kind of race, I would still expect that the fundamentals are favoring Hank Johnson. And there are some years where actually black Republican candidates are advantaged. compared to sort of what we would consider the typical district performance. And then there are some congressional election years where they're actually disadvantaged on account of their race. I think what's going to be difficult for Profit here is that this district is a majority Black district. It is a Democratic district. It has a Black incumbent. So the years where I'll see stuff pop, because you have very few districts to contend with here, are like 2014, where Mia Love and Will Hurd are winning. And they're not winning in majority Black districts, right? So, like, that's, I think, the important thing to kind of, keep in mind here. And just given how lopsided this district is, Profit's got a lot of ground to make up. And that's what's going to make this one so hard.
I like to go to facts as well. I think that's why political scientists are such a valuable contribution to your show. If you look at just the past three elections in that district, Hank Johnson was unopposed in 2012 and 2014. He had a Republican opponent in 16, and Johnson won by 51% of the vote. He won 76-24. So it's an uphill battle, I think, for Joe Profit.
Heath, your company is talking to Joe Profit about whether or not you want to be involved with this campaign. So we should say that going in. You're not yet.
That's correct. That's correct.
It is a true.
Have we discouraged you yet?
because of what we just heard from everybody else, right. This is a pretty safe Democratic district. But it is clever for the Republicans to go out and recruit an African American to try to run against Hank Johnson, or isn't it?
Well, I've tried to share on the show that we talk a lot about Democratic recruitment and new types of candidates. The Republican Party's not sitting idly by and just saying we're going to not contest these types of races. And Joe Profit, I think, represents a unique opportunity in a unique district. All politics is local. I don't think if this were a race against John Lewis or David Scott, it would have as much of a chance. But Hank Johnson is the weakest of the Democratic congressmen, both politically, with support from the financial community and from his home base. He's not known for doing much. And on top of that, Joe Profit has a unique resume and bio that you don't see even in normal African-American candidates who run as Republicans or Democrats. He's a former first-round draft pick by the Atlanta Falcons. He broke all kinds of records. He broke all kinds of racial barriers. He has this incredible story to tell about being the son of a sharecropper in Louisiana and learning through education and hard work how to better yourself. He then not only took his football fame and put it in investment, but he started businesses, and he's employed folks, and he's taken risks. So he's a unique personality.
Right. So if Strategic Partners Galloway gets involved, if they do end up on the payroll, he's already given away for free what the consulting work is he could do for Profit and helping Profit
define
himself. I don't
know how he stays in business.
This is an interesting thing in that district, right? It is an uphill battle. He knows that. But if the question is this a unique opportunity, or is this something the Republican Party embraces and starts to counterbalance Democratic recruitment in other areas?
I wouldn't discourage you from or discourage a candidate like this from emerging in this type of district, because the candidate kind of fits the demo of the district. So it would be really weird to, bring, a country club son of Confederate type of candidate into this particular district because it doesn't match. At the same time, I think, you're going in eyes open, and so what's happening there. And I think the thing about the backstory that's interesting was that if this were 1984, then I think that would be more compelling. But I think for a lot of people who are younger and newer to the district, I don't know if the story resonates as well. If Julio Jones, for instance, were your candidate, I think everybody would kind of know who he was. And then, we might have a different kind of story. But I think there's going to have to be a huge reintroduction. And your polling is probably going to have a big don't know, like at least for the first shot.
All right, we got to move on. Except one thing, Jim. Andres right about the makeup of the district. On the other hand, let's not forget Pat Swindle once represented that district. He was about the whitest white Republican you could be.
But the county
I know. It's just, I'm just throwing that in there as a little, another historical note.
Yep.
Jim, real quick, your paper yesterday had a really interesting story and disturbing story, potentially. Reporters at the AJC made an open records request to learn about how much money the city billed to Baker Donaldson, one of the city's big law firms, to work on the bribery scandal that the feds have been investigating. And what was odd about it is that that request generated what might be a brand new scandal about the whole matter, because Jeremy Berry, the attorney hired by Kasim Reed initially to be the city attorney, recreated billing invoices instead of submitting the actual invoices, and there's questions as to whether that's ethical or illegal.
Yeah, and handed them to us as if they were the original. He says he maintains that there was no violation there. He merely created a document and then handed it over. I'm not an attorney. I can't say so, but it doesn't. When the mayor's office is also generating text that says slow walk this, move as slowly as humanly possible, that is worrisome.
It also comes at a moment where Keisha Bottoms, the new mayor, has promised transparency in everything she does. At the very least, in fact, she made that statement right before we did Political Rewind live in front of the Bar Media Conference. She was the speaker right before us. At the very least, you've got to imagine, even if everything is above board, Jeremy Berry's tenure as city attorney may be short-lived with the new mayor in office.
I've had a father-in-law and several clients win the First Amendment award on open meetings, open records. Slow walking open meetings and open records never works for officials or for politicians, and the recreation of documents looks very bad.
All right. It's an interesting story. We'll watch how it unfolds. We've got time for one more quickie. Jimmy Carter taught Sunday school in Plains yesterday, and he said that he was very glad that President Trump was opening talks with Kim Jong-un because he clearly sees talk being better than nuclear war. It's not surprising Jimmy Carter would make that statement, but considering that Trump right now is under a certain amount of fire for jumping into this meeting without giving it much thought, President Carter has given him a little bit of cover. Yeah?
No question. Conservatives were already questioning what he was doing. President Carter confirmed for them that they don't like this idea. But I do think from a standpoint of diplomacy, it really creates some cover for him that he didn't have.
Before this program, I was listening to a broadcast from our friend Dennis O'Hare over at WABE. He had Sam Nunn on, asking him on the same topic. And Nunn's opinion was very much like Carter's. He says, you know, he said that, well, I wouldn't have gone into that meeting that way. I wouldn't have agreed to it that way. But now that we've got that meeting, let's not screw it up.
Yeah.
I think the irony here is that this is a president who campaigned very strongly against the Iran nuclear deal, and who has promised to upend that now that he's in office. And so if I'm the North Koreans thinking rationally about this, I may be wondering, we'll see where these conversations go, but can we trust, even if Trump enters into a deal, can we trust the next president not to undo it?
We're out of time completely. Beth Shapiro wins the sweepstakes for last comment of this particular edition of Political Rewind. Beth, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being with us. We're back, of course, on Wednesday at 2 o'clock with another Political Rewind. And then I also want to promote very quickly our two-way street on Thursday, because I'm really excited about it. Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, the king and queen of bluegrass music, are on the show, and they are just great. So we hope you join us for that, too. In the meantime, have a great evening. See you again on Wednesday.